Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, of course, reactions to the prospect of Trump being arrested at the direction of the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg dominated the news yesterday. Coming from every quarter were the responses. But something else happened yesterday, too, that's important to note just in terms of the process of this. The grand jury that District Attorney Bragg has convened perhaps heard from their final witness. Their final witness ostensibly is a guy named Robert Costello, who's a former legal advisor to their star witness, the prosecution's Michael Cohen. And here's what Robert Costello said he testified to before the grand jury. I don't know if this is going to be terribly helpful to D.A. Bragg's case if he intends to move forward with one.
I wanted him to look me in the eye and assess my credibility. Did I have more credibility than Michael Cohen? Because Michael Cohen, in my opinion, was lying about just about everything.
And that drew a reaction from former judge, Justice Neil Gorsuch clerk, Mike Davis, who said this.
Yeah, so there's a bogus legal theory, and their star witnesses are a stripper and a disbarred attorney. So good luck to you, Alvin Bragg.
Good luck to you, Alvin Bragg. 312-642-5600, third key, dot pro answer line, 643-6463, DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Yes,
you've got a bogus legal theory combined with a stripper, porn star, and a disbarred attorney. That's the case that Alvin Bragg has cobbled together that he intends to take down a former president with. And
Michael Cohen, he loves this. He was making the rounds, you know, this, Trump's a bad man.
This is about Donald Trump being held accountable for his own dirty deeds. Plain and simple.
Yeah, plain and simple.
Yeah, it's the low-rent fixer with the moralizing. It just doesn't wear very well in Michael Cohen. But, of course,
but that's the problem with Trump, because he surrounded himself with clowns.
That is a problem that he's had. But, of course, the reaction that was most discussed because of the political nature of it was the one from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, in addition to the fact that Trump is Florida resident, so the governor may have something to say about one of the residents of his state and thus a constituent. And here's what Ron DeSantis said. See if you can pick out the veiled shot at Trump.
The Manhattan district attorney is a Soros-funded prosecutor. And so he, like other Soros-funded prosecutors, they weaponize their office to impose a political agenda on society at the expense of the rule of law and public safety. He has downgraded over 50% of the felonies to misdemeanors. He says he doesn't want to even have jail time for the vast, vast majority of crimes. And what we've seen in Manhattan is we've seen the crime rate go up, and we've seen citizens become less safe. And so you're talking about this situation with, and look, I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star to secure silence over some type of alleged affair. I can't speak to that. But what I can speak to is that if you have a prosecutor who is ignoring crimes happening every single day in his jurisdiction, and he chooses to go back many, many years ago to try to use something about porn star hush money payments, you know, that's an example of pursuing a political agenda and weaponizing the office. And I think that that's fundamentally wrong.
Yeah. Look, I'm not here to talk about my opponent paying a porn star hush money to keep quiet about an alleged affair. I'm not here to talk about that. Yeah, very, very
nicely
done.
That's the shot,
done.
Dan. Yes, I know you.
Yeah, very nicely done, Ron.
But hush money payments are legal in New York, so I'm still trying to grasp around.
They're legal everywhere.
Yeah, well, okay.
I mean, you're allowed to give somebody money in exchange, you know, for specific performance. That's so long as it's not, you know, otherwise a criminal act.
Okay.
Right. The paying somebody money in and of itself for an underlying non-criminal act is not a criminal act. But in terms of DeSantis's reaction, take your reaction to DeSantis's reaction, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, because I don't think it was lost on Trump that he took a little shot from DeSantis. That his defense, DeSantis's defense of Trump, even though he did properly characterize Alvin Bragg, wasn't as vociferous as Trump would have liked, because Trump posted this: Ron DeSanctimonious will probably find out about false accusations and fake stories sometime in the future, as he gets older, wiser, and better known. When he's unfairly and illegally attacked by a woman, even classmates that are underage, or possibly a man, I'm sure he will want to fight these misfits just like I do.
I mean, he included a picture from an article from The Hill suggesting the worst about DeSantis' conduct with underage young people when he was a teacher in Georgia, some private school.
Classmates that are underage or possibly a man.
I mean, this is why he's classless. This is not even funny. I just.
It's pretty early to go after somebody's sexuality. Pretty early in the campaign. That's more of a summer.
Oh, that's a summer type of attack.
Is,
okay.
You know, raising unfounded insinuations, making unfounded insinuations about someone's sexuality. But okay, I don't think that's the path forward for Trump. But certainly this whole imbroglio is doing nothing but benefiting him politically, as I sort of anticipated it would.
But then he does this, and he releases statements like that, and a picture of DeSantis and younger women. But guess what? It's a younger DeSantis, too. It looks age-appropriate. It's not anything nefarious going on. I don't know.
I don't think it merits a substantive response, and I think for good or for bad, those kind of statements from Trump, ridiculous as they are, sort of built into the price. I just think it doesn't. It certainly doesn't attract any new supporters.
No.
But I don't think it repels any current supporters.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Because I know he could do no wrong. I mean, Trump supporters I know are, you know, they probably saw this and laughed. But I saw that and thought that was tasteless and classless.
Got it. Bill and Glen Ellen, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Got it.
I know. Yeah, I voted for Trump the first time, and if he gets the nomination, I'll vote for him again. But I'm a DeSantis. I hope DeSantis runs, because that statement by him shows exactly why he's a much stronger, better candidate than Trump will ever be. I mean, it was rational. The shot he took was subtle without being over the top. And
I think he is just altogether
much, much better than Trump. And I hope Trump supporters realize this and start understanding that Trump has a very low ceiling that he will never be able to get past, with a lot of people who just think they just hate him as a person. Whereas DeSantis is a fresh slate, and he is everything Trump is. He's Trump 2.0 without any of the defects that we know of so far. I mean, it's a long campaign, so we'll see. But I really like DeSantis, and I hope he can go all the way, because we need to beat these people in 2024, because this country is just a wreck.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Alex Hinsdale.
Hi, good morning, guys. Two quick comments. The New York statute of limitations on a misdemeanor is 2 years, a felony 5 if they could somehow, a new legal, they could tie it the first time in the history of our country. So on both of those, it falls from statute of limitations. This is about Bragg wanting to be governor of New York. The other thing, though, about DeSantis. I think DeSantis has done a wonderful job for an inexperienced governor so far. But when you look at the left, they're showing you there is only one person that they are afraid of. They're not afraid of Ron DeSantis. They're afraid of Donald Trump because he's figured them out. They'll call DeSantis a racist, a misogynist. And as soon as Trump was out of the way, they'll destroy him where he stands. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for the call, Alex. My favorite reaction yesterday actually didn't come from a politician. It came from a comedian.
Who?
Chris Rock. Chris Rock said, are you guys really going to arrest Trump? Do you know this is only going to make him more popular? It's like arresting Tupac. That's awesome. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, good morning, Dan. Thank you. And hey, thank you for taking my call. Boy, I'll tell you what. My wife and I, we've been all along really big on DeSantis as a governor and really a great guy, possibility for a presidential. But I'll tell you what, in this past, like, say, year or something, with this whole thing with DeSantis stepping out and just causing Trump kind of like a headache, just being a pain in his butt with, like, if he's going to run, if he's not going to run, his veiled little comments and all this kind of thing. It's like a guy that, like, they have a saying about putting a tink in his own armor or tarnish his own. That's what he's doing.
What was the problem with what Ron DeSantis said yesterday? He criticized Alvin Bragg. He basically said the same thing a lot of people are saying about the quality of this prospective case, which is it is a bogus legal theory that he's pursuing. This is to no particular end. This is weaponizing the prosecutor's office. It's all of those things. So what was the problem with what he said?
Oh, it's exactly this. He comes out there, and it's because it's on top of all these other little things of basically trying to get in the way of Trump just running clean, leaving Trump just have that lane wide open.
Well, here he comes out. You don't want Ron DeSantis to run, but I mean, you know, I want him to run
after Trump.
Well, Trump has been there, so now DeSantis should run. You're not allowed to run. I don't like Ron DeSantis now because he wants to run for president. If he's been a good right governor and you liked him until this point, you just don't like him. You like Trump more. But, I mean, Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley, Mike Pompeo, everybody, Mike Pence, everybody has a right to run. I don't think you get mad at them for that. I don't know. I just don't think that's a strong argument. And with respect to Trump supporters, you know, I would think that you'd respect DeSantis even taking a veiled shot at Trump. I mean, you love when Trump tears people apart, including in the Republican primary. If you want to beat Trump, you got to stand up to him. You can't just sit back there and take it like little Marco, like Sleepy Jeb.
Well, that's
right.
True. Yeah, we don't want that person.
So, I mean, the rhetorical haymakers can be thrown by people other than Trump, too. That's fair, isn't it?
Well, Dan, did you like what DeSantis said, his response?
I think it was fine. They're trying to whip this into controversy, and Trump is trying to take full advantage of this by putting some air in it by taking the weird shot at DeSantis that he did. But DeSantis' comments were perfectly fine. I mean, they were center cut on the substance of the case. And as if anybody needs a reminder, you know, hearkening back to some of the more curious choices Trump has made in his personal life in particular. I mean, it's fair game. Come on. Everybody needs to grow up a little bit.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
This guy is the most biased reporter, NBC. I think CNN has more credibility than NBC.
On AM 560.
Did you hear what I said? I said you have more credibility than this guy. And that's not saying much.
The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about reactions to the prospect of Trump being arrested by the Manhattan District Attorney. We'll see what transpires today. Take a couple more calls on this, and then we need to get to our friends Tony Fauci and Muriel Bowser, the mayor of D.C., and their jaunt through the neighborhoods in D.C. back in the summer of 2021, pushing the vax like a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses. Phil in Maryville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, everybody. I just want to say that it's getting real old with all the people attacking Trump because what he says. He's the most attacked president in this history of our country. And if we need a fighter for this country, I mean, who cares what he says? It's done and over with. And if we keep going down the same path and don't have a fighter, we're going to get the same old thing.
Well, okay, Phil. Thanks for the call. I understand your point about Trump and being a fighter, and that's an attractive quality, taking it to the other side, revealing the other side for who they are like no other. I get it. But you can't say, I want a fighter, but then say, well, but Ron DeSantis, you're not allowed to be a fighter. You can't say it doesn't matter what he says, but it matters what Ron DeSantis says or anybody else. You know, words are the currency of politics. Great man once said that. Who is that, Amy?
Dan Proft.
That's right. That was me. And so Trump is held accountable for his words, yes. You know, however people want to or not want to. It's up to you. But the words matter. That's how political discourse. This is how we size people up and make decisions based on what they say and then what they do and how close what they said they would do to what they actually did turned out to be. But I mean, you can't just like Trump's rhetoric doesn't matter, but everybody else's does.
It does.
Trump
matter.
Doesn't need to be accountable for anything he says, but everybody else does. Trump can fight and take on people, but other people can't take on Trump. That doesn't work that way. That's not right.
And I know he's been under a number of investigations. First, it was Russia, then the phone call with Zelensky, then tax returns, then his business records. Then they went after his children. And now this, you know, alleged bookkeeping error. So if he becomes president again, it's just going to keep going and going. But I don't even think if he's just a regular citizen, President Trump, they're still going to go after him. They will not stop attacking him.
Of course, there's
a case in Georgia. There's this case. There's another one pending.
And the impeachments and
the case
that Bragg is trying to put together in Manhattan, the case they're trying to put together in Fulton County, Georgia, the case DOJ, they're all frivolous cases.
But can you help
not
me?
Not a single one of them are meritorious.
Right.
Okay. So, right. And so I appreciate that he's willing to stand and deliver and constantly be on offense in spite of the onslaught. That is something that is a noteworthy. And this is one of the reasons he has such a loyal base. I get it. But you can't say nobody else gets to play. Nobody else gets to have a say. I mean, that's not right.
But can you help me out? So the DOJ didn't bring the case. The federal prosecutor of New York didn't touch it. And didn't originally, you said yesterday, Mr. Bragg himself didn't want to bring the case?
No, his office.
His office
before didn't. Before he was a district attorney, the Manhattan DEA's office also passed on this case. Alvin Bragg gets in, and he wants to make his political chops on this one. So he takes a second look at it and is now apparently on the cusp of moving forward with it.
But didn't he get pressure from the left because Trump announced his presidency during that time?
Pressure from the left. He is the left. I mean, he's Soros funded, as has been said by everyone, because it's appropriate to remind people. This is who these people are. This is why Soros funds them, to be political apparatchiks, not to be prosecutors. They're not there to call balls and strikes. They're not there to apply equal enforcement of the law. They're there to advance the flag of the left. And so that's what Alvin Bragg is trying to do. And figures, oh, I'll get some profile out of it, too, even if it goes nowhere. I took on the fight against Trump, and you'll have all the left cable news networks rally around him, and he'll get profile and be able to raise money, and he'll go on to the next thing. After Letitia James gets done with AG and she moves on to governor, then Alvin Bragg will slip into the AG's office, and the wheel keeps spinning. That's what this is about.
Yeah.
This has nothing to do with the rule of law. Tom Mount Greenwood.
Weird, classless, however you'd like to describe what Trump said. I really don't care either. I'm like Phil. I agree with him.
A groomer. DeSantis.
He didn't call him a groomer, well, but I mean he's just
insinuating.
He's insinuating.
He insinuates yeah. lots. He says,
well,
lots.
I know.
But guess what? Guess what else he does? And Dan just said it. He made our country successful. That's all I care about. He can say whatever he wants. And we've all learned to figure that out. He will say whatever he wants. We're not going to change him.
No.
Life was better under a Trump presidency, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean,
weren't living paycheck to paycheck. People had a life.
It's not always the rhetorical style that's most attractive to me, but is it the most important thing, the name calling and stuff? No, it's not. I mean, I agree with that, but I'm just saying you can't say Ron DeSantis, you're not allowed to put on the gloves. That's just not a tenable position. David in Winnetka.
Yeah, I take the same stance as these two gentlemen. I was never into politics. I never followed it. Couldn't care less. Had enough to worry about as was until 2020. And then, but you think about it, like when they run and they talk about words, they make these promises, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, da 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 da. I don't remember Trump really saying anything other than he was going to drain the swamp and do exactly what he said he was going to do. Who gives a damn about anything else? Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call. I mean, as much as many character flaws as Trump has, and they've been on full display for many decades, which is why they've been built into the price. I repeated this observation many times because of the source mainly, and it was our friend Rusty Reno, who's the editor at First Things. This is a devout conservative Catholic guy who does not appreciate Trump's character either. And what did he say? He said, by the standard, I'm paraphrasing here, but by the standard of did you do or attempt to do what you said you would do when you ran for office upon gaining office? By that standard, Trump is the most honest president we've ever had, or certainly in the last century and 20 years, the most honest president we've ever had. So for all of the by that standard, which is the performance standard, a conservative Catholic who is mainly repelled by Trump's personal conduct and rhetorical choices as well, the most honest president of the last century plus. Yeah, and that matters. Totally get it. All right, we'll come back and we'll do Fauci and Bowser ambulating through the neighborhoods of D.C. after this. Dan and Amy.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Dan and Amy, so PBS is this series called American Masters, which reputedly is to help viewers, quote, discover insightful profiles of important figures in America's artistic and cultural life.
Oh, my God. Please.
Well, Muriel Bowser, the mayor of D.C., and that sad little man, Tony Fauci. Oh, that's an opportunity to play that song again.
Oh, we missed it.
Sad little man, Tony Fauci. They don't qualify, but some of the residents that they ran into in D.C., they do qualify as important figures in America's artistic and cultural life, because you want to hear some truth being spoken to power. This was really sort of interesting, and it was interesting as well that, again, these clips were not left on the cutting room floor, that they actually are going to be aired as part of this. This is Fauci and Bowser going through the neighborhoods in D.C., June of 2021, pushing their vax. And one gentleman was not interested.
Because when you start talking about paying people to get vaccinated, when you start talking about incentivizing things to get people vaccinated, it's something else going on with that.
It's something else going on. You're right. But I'm glad millions of people, like me and most everybody here, didn't get an incentive. You know what their incentive was? Protecting their health and protecting the city.
My incentive, y'all campaign is about fear. It's about inciting fear in people. You all attack people with fear. That's what this pandemic is. It's a fear. It's fear, this pandemic. That's all it is.
That guy figured it out.
You are right. I cannot believe they didn't cut that out. Good for them.
When Muriel Bowser said, you're right, there is something to that, paying people to vax, there's something more to that, the gentleman said, the mayor Bowser said, yeah, there is something to that. What is it? Since you agree with them, what do you mean by that?
What's in it for the government?
Yeah, because I think I know what he means by it, but I want to know what the mayor means by it.
I mean, they gave kids CAPE, the Great America tickets. You can get vaccinated at Great America for free once you get in for free. $50 Visa cards. Then they bumped it up to $100 Visa cards. Then they came to your house, and if you had a member of five, each kid and mom and dad got a Visa card for $100.
Well, here's another one. Maybe there's a producer over at PBS who doesn't like Tony Fauci, because this is not a very positive exchange for Fauci with a D.C. resident, a woman, who has an understanding about the vaccine that Fauci corrects. But let's see if you make the call. This is like IBM. You make the call. You make the call. Who turned out to be right with respect to this exchange?
I'm ready.
Well, I heard that it doesn't cure it, and it doesn't stop you from getting it.
No. So on the very, very, very rare chance that you do get it, even if you're vaccinated, it's a very, you don't even feel sick. It's like you don't even know you got infected.
Oh, my God.
It's very, very.
What a lie.
The very rare chance you get it if you've been vaxxed. Really?
And if you do, it's very rare. You won't even know that you have it. Do you know how many people all of us know who've been vaccinated, double vaxxed, quadruple vaxxed, who get COVID, who are in a great deal of pain?
But also just. It doesn't prevent transmission.
Right?
That's the key.
I mean, come on. Right. That too, obviously.
I would nominate either one of those D.C. residents that you just heard from to be the new NIAID director over Tony Fauci.
He wants to be a reality TV star so badly. That's what this was all about him and his image and promoting himself.
He's science. We know that. We also know that he's post-partisan. This is not about partisan politics. Okay. He doesn't think about partisan politics. He just thinks about science and data and saving lives, right? That's what we know about St. Tony Fauci.
What are we going to do about those other states?
Oh, my God. They're going to keep the outbreak smoldering in the country. It's so crazy. I mean, they're not doing it because they say they don't want to do it. They're Republicans. They don't like to be told what to do.
Right.
And we got to break that, you know, unpack.
Republicans are keeping the outbreak smoldering. That's what he was saying to Mayor Bowser in June of 21.
Look at the infection rates between Republican states and Democratic-run states. They're, if not similar, they're less. And he knows that. It gave him an opportunity to bash the Republican Party because he's a lifelong Democrat.
Frank, Arlington Heights, here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Who are the people in the neighborhood? In the neighborhood. In the neighborhood. Who are the people in the neighborhood? Who you meet each day? That is Sesame Street.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's about what I felt like watching that. And I almost felt almost like Mr. Rogers, too, that we were going to get Lady Elaine. Or the little cat.
Meow, meow, meow.
Meow, 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 meow.
Yeah. Yeah.
King Friday and Prince Wednesday or Tuesday or whatever his name is.
Fauci's about the size of King Friday. Yeah,
he is. That was execrable, the entire performance by him and Bowser. And I'm glad they got some pushback from the people in their neighborhood there.
Yeah.
Because he's a liar. And were these people right about anything in regards to COVID? Anything? You've mentioned that before, Dan. I don't think so.
It's hard to think of something they were correct about. We poured over it with Marty Makary, and we were struggling. We got a running list. He's put it together of the myths that they promulgated that have been debunked. But in terms of where they had foresight, that is a short list if there's any items on that list at all. Thanks
for
the call.
Fauci would look like a good Mr. McFeely. That's who he'd look like. The guy from Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Frank.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Will Waterloo High School be the identitarian left's Waterloo?
Ah, I see what you did there.
Yeah, a little Napoleonic reference.
Waterloo High School.
Waterloo High School is in Monroe County, down St. Louis Way, Metro East. A bit of a contretemps there over bathroom usage. There's a trans student, and the other students, many of the other students, don't want to go to the bathroom with somebody of the opposite sex. And so they were going to the single service bathroom in the nurse's office, and that created a line, which created a controversy, which created an administrative response that included suggestions that students were being taken aside by teachers and staff and talk to about being more trans friendly as well as possibly disciplined.
Oh, please.
Ryan Cunningham is a parents advocate down that way. He was on a local radio show, the Mark Reardon Show, describing the situation and what was termed a protest.
There's a trans student at the Waterloo High School that the staff has decided to allow to use whichever bathroom that they choose. And the students that felt uncomfortable with that, they were told that they could use the nurse's restroom, which is a single stall bathroom. Well, come Friday, you had 300 plus students lining up single file line to use the single stall bathroom because they didn't feel comfortable, using a bathroom with a member of the opposite sex. So the school took that as a form of a protest. These kids are uncomfortable that are left with no other choice, and now the heavy hand of this school is literally calling them, sending emails out saying essentially it's a hate crime and it's bullying, and they're threatening discipline to these kids who just want to use the restroom on their own.
And of course, the school hiding behind the lawyers, hiding behind ISBE, Illinois State Board of Education guidance, and terming it the law. Our hands are tied. This is not a comment on our position on the particular issue, but our hands are tied here per the Illinois Human Rights Act and Biden's executive order and the ISBE guidance. Ryan Cunningham responding to that argument that was made by the school in defense of what they've done here, allowing the student to go to the bathroom of their choosing.
They absolutely don't have a point. The guidance that they are relying on, and yes, I use that word correctly, it is guidance from the Illinois State Board of Education that their attorneys are providing them as a legal framework that was drafted by Governor J.B. Pritzker, the teachers union, and what I call far-left activist law firms, which is one of Waterloo's law firms, believe it or not. And that is the guidance that is given by ISBE. And it is not a law. It is not mandate. It is not, it's not said in the Illinois school code anywhere. And in fact, this is a legal argument that we're considering challenging in the courts if necessary. And what's even more interesting out of this, the most recent case that has been decided in this actually comes out of an appellate federal court in Florida just in December of 2022 that specifically says in order to not violate equal protections, it is okay for a district to come up with a policy. You can have a gender, male gender bathroom, a female gender bathroom, and then you can have this bathroom that it doesn't matter who or where wants to go in there.
Yeah. Simple solution, but they don't want that solution. Golly gee, why don't they want it? I wonder.
I mean, everybody changes the rule for one person. And who in their right mind thinks 300 people could share one bathroom stall to begin with? Of course there's going to be long lines. And it's not fair for them.
Does this get your attention? By the way, you know, Monroe County, for those of you not familiar, that is a pretty strong Republican county. Pretty conservative area. And yet, do we have your attention now when it comes to school board races on the ballot in your locale, April 4th? Are you paying attention?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Anybody want to talk about their local school board races? Anybody want to pump a candidate running for your local school board? Are you paying attention? I know some people are interested because we've gotten a lot of emails asking for recommendations when it comes to particular school board races, and I've been providing them, and we'll provide them here too. But just, you know, Chicago mayor's race, I get it, that's important. Some local mayor's races, those are important too. But the school boards, you know, this especially for school choice proponents. Remember how this cultural Marxism works. It starts at the elite private schools and then makes its way to the public schools. Or they are at least at minimum on parallel tracks. The teachers unions driving it in the government school systems and the offals and cultural Marxists in elite circles driving it in the upscale private schools. So I say for school choice proponents because school choice is a positive reform. Competition always is. But it is not a panacea. What sort of choice is it if you're choosing between New Trier and what Loyola Academy has become on the North Shore, for example? Not much of one. Not much of one. Better football team at Loyola. That's about it. In terms of the academic culture, how much different is it? How much different are these schools in wealthy, the government schools in wealthy areas that people move to? I got to get in that school system. Our friends at Wire Points just put out a report card on some of the biggest school districts in Illinois. Not named CPS. Like my hometown school district. You ready for these numbers? We'll talk about it more with Ted at the bottom of the 7 o'clock hour. But this, I think, will be surprising to a lot of people in Wheaton-Warrenville School District 200. Wheaton. Wheaton. Conservative. Used to be. In Wheaton-Warrenville School District 200, property taxes have gone up 30% in the past decade. 44% of the students are reading at grade level. 45% can do math at grade level.
Oh my God. In Wheaton?
Less than half. Do we have your attention now? Because it's about cultural Marxism, yes, but it's also about cultural Marxism's impact on academic performance, both in terms of instruction and the transfer of knowledge, the training in critical thinking. When your focus is on politics and training political activists, other things suffer. Yes? No?
Yeah, their priorities are out of whack. We got a lot of text message. Dan and Amy, what about District 303? What about District 214? Proviso Township School Board elections.
I'll give you some.
Do we have
Feel free to call in and add to the list.
312-642-5600 or text us 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
For Wheaton-Warrenville, District 200, mm-hmm. since we mentioned it. Kim Hobbs for the two-year district. Amy Erkenswick, Garrett Spencer, Dave Somer. Those are the four candidates I'd recommend.
Are they running together on a slate or separate?
I don't know the particulars. Okay. Those are the names. Hobbs, Erkenswick, Spencer, Summer. And there are other people involved in this, too. And part of this is relying on people you trust around the region to provide a little bit of a handle on the local landscape. Would you say 211? 214?
214, District 214.
214, the only one I can recommend at this point is Elizabeth Bauer. She's running in 214. Somebody said 303.
Yep.
St. Charles. Joe Lackner, Matt Kuchert, Dolores Van Heel, Tom Lentz for the two-year term. Four candidates. Some of these, you know, and part of the problem is in some of these school districts, you don't have three or four good candidates for all the open seats. You just have left and left. So, you know, 214. I can make one recommendation, but in some of these other districts, you have a chance to turn over the school board and restore some sanity and focus and maybe reduce the pace at which your property taxes increase and thus your home value decreases. If any of those things are important to people, I don't know. I don't know what is anymore.
And then you might have some control over what books are in the library.
Well, all of that,
same,
of course.
Same with, you know, Barrington's District 220.
Eric in Rolling Meadows.
Hey, good morning, guys. 211's getting really ugly out here. There's a lot of Facebook hate and everybody comparing the more conservative positions to, like, DeSantis. And it's getting pretty interesting, but they're getting pretty ugly over here, calling each other out towards the more conservatives. It's interesting. What are your thoughts?
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks for the call. It's because it should be a fight. It's important. You fight for things that are important. 211, four candidates. Mark Kramer, Pete Dombrowski, Susan Sam, Barb Velez. Those are your four candidates in 211, okay. From my perspective. One man's opinion. George in Naperville.
Dan, wouldn't that be a private personal choice about what you feel comfortable with as far as that bathroom issue? They want to take people's thinking away from them.
I'm sorry, I don't exactly know what you're saying.
As far as having to go to the bathroom with a trans, I'm saying if a woman or a man felt uncomfortable with that, why would they take that personal choice away from them?
Take the personal choice away from the person who
of
feels...
Of having to go or having to be in a situation where they would be in a bathroom with that, you know...
Well, right, a girl in the bathroom with a boy, right. Yes, right.
Exactly.
Thanks for the call, George. That's the whole point. The whole point is that accommodation only goes in one direction. Consideration only goes in one direction. It's fine if everybody else is uncomfortable, feels unsafe to use the language of the left. That's okay, so long as one of the left's mascots is made comfortable. And that's all they are to the left, by the way. All their talk about love and transhumans and human dignity and so on and so forth. They're just political chess pieces. Yeah. That's all they are.
They need you to push their cause.
Chuck and Delavan.
It seems from the narrative, it seems like it's
a boy that's trying to use the girl's bathroom. I don't know if I got it right or not. But
I suspect.
It was like, pardon?
Yeah, I suspect that's the case, right?
Well, it was like that one kid that was down there that was raping the girls. I mean, whatever happened to the days of old when grandfathers would take care of, or parents would take care of that stuff and go talk to the other parents and tell them to knock that stuff off. I don't know why they don't do that anymore.
Yeah, well, that's a great point, Chuck, in terms of, like, yeah, adult-to-adult interaction, because there's just not as many adults roaming around as there used to be. We don't have problem solvers because we have policies and procedures and lawyers and administrators and social workers and therapists. Moms and dads hashing this out? No. Terry, Rogers Park.
Why don't they just build a separate bathroom for transgenders?
Well,
that has been done in certain places.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Well, that's actually what Ryan Cunningham just mentioned there. There's this boys, girls, and nondescript. But in many places,
it's called gender neutral, because I was in one yesterday.
In many places, that's not good enough, because you're not celebrating. You're not celebrating. Why do I need to be ostracized as I say I'm a girl, so I get to go to the girls' bathroom, you see.
With the other girls. You're right. Discriminating against me.
Correct.
That's so a middle of the road is not going to suffice.
I mean, remember this wonderful interview that Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, did a few months ago with Dylan Mulvaney, this 26-year-old dude pretending to be a female.
Oh, that's the one that Drew Barrymore got on her knees for, right?
Yeah, they had a moment.
They had a moment.
Yeah.
She was consoling him.
Yeah, right. Remember that conversation, President of the United States, indulging this. But of course they are. And what was the perspective?
Thank you. And it feels like Republicans have turned trans and non-binary people into this thing to blame society's downfall on in some ways. And this narrative is not only dangerous to our mental health, but also our physical safety. And particularly trans women of color are being murdered at an alarming rate.
More than any other group of people.
Thank you. How can Democratic leaders be more effective in advocating for us trans people and our families and our lives and our opportunities?
I'm not being facetious when I say this, being seen with people like you. No, I mean it. I genuinely mean it.
I mean it. God.
Being seen with people like Dylan Mulvaney, Mr. President. So a 26-year-old man pretending to be a woman, pretending to be a 6-year-old girl.
I am Eloise. I am 6. I'm a city child. I live at the Plaza Hotel, which is huge and wonderful and très élégant, especially at Christmas time.
Those are the kinds of videos that he posts dressed up as a 6-year-old girl, talking like a 6-year-old girl, to doing like an Eloise, some children's book or something, I don't know, impersonation. Yeah. Those are the kind of videos that he posts on TikTok, which have made him this TikTok celebrity and corporate spokes being. Right. That's what we need to be seen with to respect the dignity of every. What a bunch of pablum. Just utter nonsense. So call it what it is. And by the way, because I don't want to celebrate particular perversions or illnesses does not mean I'm scapegoating. I don't want to see you and hear you. You got every right that I do. You're equal in the eyes of the Lord. And so just stop with your navel-gazing bull jive and stop indulging people saying things that aren't true. There is this targeted group that suffers more violence. That is not the case. We've gone over the data on that. I mean, it's just a ridiculous proposition that was offered there in that exchange between Biden and Mulvaney, number one. And again, the point is to say you do your thing, particularly when you're of age, when you're no longer a minor. You do your thing, but the idea that your thing involves reordering everybody else's thing, reordering the entirety of society around your particular proclivities or challenges is a bit self-indulgent, don't you think? A bit narcissistic, don't you think? Lacking in being other-regarding, to use the lingo, don't you think? That's what this is about. I'm not marginalizing, hurting anybody other than your feelings, I guess, because I disagree with you. I won't play along. I don't want to. And you don't have to play along with me. You know, run around demanding people call you by these pronouns. Run around with alter egos. Run around in a furry costume. Whatever you want to do. But you don't get to impose your will on everybody else and demand celebration through enforcement within all of our cultural and civic institutions. That's what this is about. That's what identitarianism is. It's a 21st century form of totalitarianism. That's who these individuals are. And they're all over your school boards. School boards and K through 12 administrations are rotten with these people. And April 4th is a chance to rebalance. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
A couple more endorsements. We'll keep adding and keep mentioning names, so we'll get to as many regions as we can. District 205 in Elmhurst, here are the four. Tom Chavez, Lan Lee, Linda Nadura, and Jamie Esker Scher. Chavez, Lee, Nadura, and Esker Scher. In Barrington 220, Katie Baldassano, Leonard Munson, Matt Sheriff. Baldassano, Munson, Sheriff.
Yeah, we hit them on the air. They came in, all three of them.
We'll keep going as the days wind down to April 4th.
Yeah, hopefully make a spreadsheet for everybody and tweet it out.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. In addition to our conversation about Trump's legal prospects starting in Manhattan, our friend Julie Kelly from American Greatness offered testimony before the House Judiciary Committee on January 6th prisoners. And since we're really talking about the rule of law here versus the politicization of the law, the Sovietization of the law, meaning show me the man and I'll show you the crime. Her commentary, running commentary and coverage on January 6th prisoners is important, as is the testimony she provided yesterday in part.
The situation is so egregious that the D.C. District Court formed a committee to attempt to resolve the problem between defense attorneys and detainees accessing their evidence. Judge Randolph Moss blasted the D.C. jail for withholding evidence from an accused defendant. I can't allow someone to sit in prison for this long without access for material, Moss said back in July, calling the delays utterly unacceptable and not consistent with due process. But 6 months later, the situation does not appear to be improving.
And those people are still in pretrial detention, 22 hours a day in a cage. And many of them are not charged with violent offenses. This from a regime that otherwise doesn't believe in pretrial detention for anybody except those who allegedly violated any law on January 6th. So the conversation about Trump that we've been having, well, for years now, it is much broader than Trump. And I think we need to remind ourselves of that. That this is happening, as one would expect, if it can happen to a former president, it can happen to ordinary citizens. It is happening to ordinary citizens in real time. For more on this, Pleased to be joined again by our friend George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor, regular contributor to the American Spectator, and he blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. George, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you, Dan.
So just, I mean, general commentary, particularly given your experience as a prosecutor at both the federal and state level, about the rule of law in this country and what cases like Trump may or may not be facing in Manhattan, what the DOJ's handling of January 6th offenders, alleged offenders, what that tells us about the state of the rule of law in this country.
Well, start with the January 6th alleged offenders. I read yesterday or the day before that the Department of Justice is preparing to charge approximately 1,000 more individuals who may have been in the vicinity of the Capitol. I mean, we don't know what they're supposed to have done. But, you know, you've got a highly politicized Department of Justice, and that's bad enough. But if you look at what's happening with the January 6th defendants, the courts are in on it, too. I mean, the district court, the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, all of the judges on that bench are letting this happen to those defendants who are being held on this pretrial detention status. And we're 2 years into this? I mean, even longer for some of these guys. It's really beyond belief that the court is allowing this to go on.
Well, and especially you heard from Julie Kelly reading from a district court judge's opinion on the matter of discovery and those who are charged having access to discovery information in preparation of their defense. And he decried the violation of due process, but they haven't done anything about it. We've from the video to tapes that Tucker Carlson got, we see now, and according to the QAnon Shaman's defense attorney, there was a material evidence that should have been provided the defense by the federal government that apparently wasn't. I mean, these are like black letter violations of due process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the judge can decry whatever he wants. He has it within his power. If any of these defendants happens to be before him, that judge can solve the problem, the immediate problem, by releasing the defendant. And let him, you know, why does he have to sit in a jail cell while this comedy, I call it a comedy, it's actually just this nonsense, is being acted out? Pretrial detention for 2 years for what these people are alleged to have done is absurd. It shouldn't happen to anybody. If you've got the goods on a defendant, you go to trial. You don't arrest somebody and then, you know, let them sit there for 2 years or more. Leading up to trial. So yeah, the judge, I'm really happy the judge wrote this opinion, but he really needs to actually do something about it. And all of the other people on that court down there need to do something about it, take action. They're allowing this to happen on their watch, and it's outrageous.
It sounds like they're political prisoners, and why are they dragging their feet and just letting them rot in prison like this?
Well, I think now that we've seen the videos that Tucker Carlson has put on the air, what we're beginning to see is, hey, guess what? It wasn't an insurrection. It was a guided tour by the Capitol Police for most of these people who were very well behaved, I might add, and yet they're being locked up. So I think one of the reasons that they're dragging their feet was they knew that someday there was going to be a day of reckoning when some of this was going to have to come out. I mean, thank God for Tucker Carlson, and thank God that for the Republicans who finally got the nerve up to, and the majority in the House to get these videos released. I mean, it goes completely counter to what we have been told incessantly since January 6th. This is not an insurrection. This was not a violent uprising. You had a few knuckleheads doing things they shouldn't have done, and the rest of these people need to be let out of jail.
Mike Davis, who's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, said of the Manhattan DA's case against Trump, you basically have a bogus legal theory with your star witnesses, a porn star, and a disbarred attorney. Good luck. Does that about sum it for you?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I can't even figure out what the legal theory is. I mean, I haven't seen anything definitive on it, but, you know, I don't know how a local district attorney takes charge of what is purportedly a federal law violation. How does that happen? And if you go back to this, every statute of limitations I'm familiar with ran long ago on any potential crime arising out of it. But as crazy as all of that is, the fact of the matter is this Soros DA in Manhattan, once he brings the charge in Manhattan, he won't have any trouble finding a compliant judge and a jury willing to convict Trump. So he can come up with any goofy legal theory he wants. He can have the worst witnesses in the world. And I guarantee you there will be a jury ready, willing, and able sitting in Manhattan ready to drop the hammer on Trump.
Now, go on, Dan.
Something else that Trump's defense team said over the weekend as the rumors were circulating because of his post that he was going to be arrested today, that, you know, we don't know. This is all tea leaf reading because the district attorney's office hasn't been communicating with us. There was some reporting that, oh, the district attorney's office was starting to communicate with Secret Service to in you know preparation to allow Trump to turn himself in. But that seems unclear now. And his defense attorneys, former President Trump's defense attorney, saying, yeah, it's unusual, but we haven't gotten any communication from Bragg's office, so we don't know where things stand or what he intends to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, why should there be a communication? It's only a former president of the United States. They get this kind of case every day, I'm sure.
Right. But is it, from your experience, do they have a point that it's unusual that you wouldn't be communicating, even if it wasn't a former president?
No, I mean, if you're getting ready to make a high-profile arrest, I mean, it could be, you know, some guy off the street, and it's a case of great public interest. And you're going to work this out in advance. I mean, you sit down with the other side and say, here's what's coming. Here's how we want to do this. You know, have your, of course, this, I go back to the days when we allowed people to self-surrender.
Right.
You know, that's not in the playbook anymore. You know, you can be, you know, some guy who protested an abortion clinic and they'll send a SWAT team out to get you. So, and look, this guy Bragg, I mean, he's your basic progressive Soros prosecutor. Right. He never met a violent criminal he didn't like, and he's on a mission now. And guaranteed, this will make him a hero to the left, and this will launch his political career into the stratosphere if he's the guy who locked up Trump.
Yeah, he made a household name for himself. So is there a possibility that Trump will not be indicted?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I saw one of Trump's lawyers last night on television, and he said, well, it's not a done deal, which I don't know exactly what that means. And I hope it's not a done deal, because I think it would just be a tragic and awful milestone for this country to have a former president locked up, especially on some kind of trumped up idiotic charge. And so if it's not a done deal, well, that's good news. But I don't think Trump and his team would have been talking about this unless they had been given a clear indication previously that it was going to happen. Now, maybe they're getting a little nervous over in the Bragg side, but
that would be, I mean, per your description of Bragg, which is accurate, that would be a real walk back if he got all the way up to the edge and he blinked, and then he goes from hero to zero in that crowd that whose support he desires so much. So, Boy, I don't know how. And apparently, you know, it was supposed to be wrapped up yesterday with Costello, Mike Cohen's former attorney, a legal advisor. But apparently there's one more witness that he's going to bring. They're doing an awful lot to, you know, to give the appearance of legitimacy in terms of moving on the former president. That plus the politics of this. I'd be surprised if Bragg didn't go forward. I think he's all in at this point.
Yeah, it'd be like chickening out at the when you're getting ready to do the bungee jump. You know, you go from here, like you said, here to zero. I don't see how Bragg backs out of this at this stage. And he has everything to gain by going ahead against Trump and everything to lose if he doesn't do it now. And again, he knows, you know, the system that he's working with. And the system in New York City guaranteed Trump is going to get convicted. And even if Trump didn't get convicted, Bragg could still say, yeah, but I took action where nobody else would. This guy needed to go down, and I'm the man who tried to take him down. He comes out a hero if he charges Trump, and he you know, blows it all if he doesn't follow through with this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we heard Maxine Waters, No Justice, No Peace, Maxine, over the weekend as she tours the country going from bank to bank with her tin can out. She all she hears from people is, when is Trump going to be arrested? I mean, so people forget that they're only interested in appealing to half the country because that's enough to get their bread buttered. And that's enough for Alvin Bragg to get profiled that leads him to the next post in New York State. Or New York City mayor, who knows? That's you know, you have to understand their calculus. They're not thinking about it from a law and order perspective. They're thinking about it strictly from a political one.
Absolutely. And, you know, Bragg has to keep in mind that we got another lunatic progressive DA down in Atlanta, my old hometown, who's getting ready to bring charges against Trump for election interference.
It's a race to the courthouse.
I don't know how. Yeah, I don't know how a candidate can be charged with election interference in his own election, but hey, these people are breaking new ground every day in the law. They're going to come up with these inventive theories, and, you know, they're the ones with the charging power. So just stand by. If Bragg doesn't do it, Fannie Willis down in Atlanta will, and she'll become the hero.
George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor, regular contributor to the American Spectator. He blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. George, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Always great being with you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Chinese communist dictator Xi visits friendly neighbor. It's referenced Putin in Moscow. Friendly neighbor, the Russian, sure. Mutual Admiration Society, the two communist dictators.
They're on the welcome wagon committee,
Ostensibly, they were riding shirtless and bareback across Siberia or some such thing to enjoy each other's company.
Yeah. After swimming in a cold pond, yes.
What should we expect to come from this, if anything? And also, what should America be doing to exacerbate the internal contradictions in both of these communist countries? You know, it was internal contradictions in addition to Reagan's peace through strength that ultimately led to the downfall of the Soviet Union. Glasnost and perestroika was not something Gorbachev wanted to do. It was something he thought he was compelled to do to try to keep that empire afloat. And, of course, it just hastened the implosion. What can we do, if anything, to hasten the implosion of communism in Russia and China? For more on this, pleased to be joined by Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China and The Great U.S.-China Tech War, You can follow Gordon Chang on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang, C-H-A-N-G, Gordon G. Chang is his handle on Twitter. Gordon Chang, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much, Dan and Amy.
What did you make of the preemptive strike rhetorically by National Security Council spokes being John Kirby to say if what comes out of this Putin-Xi meeting is some talk about a ceasefire, an embrace of the Chinese peace plan, then that should be dismissed out of hand because, of course, that would seek only to cement Russia's illegitimate territorial gains. Is that the right posture for America to take?
I think it is. I rarely agree with John Kirby, but I believe that he's right. There's two reasons. One he gave, which was it would ratify Russia's possession of Ukrainian territory as a practical matter. The second is that at least for the moment, Ukraine has the initiative on the battlefield. That can change, but at least now Ukraine has the upper hand. So a ceasefire actually helps Russia. Now, I think that China has proposed a ceasefire because they understand what is going on in the war. They wouldn't propose something that would undercut their ally effectively, which is Vladimir Putin's Russia.
Well, but also, I mean, aren't both of them just posturing to but pretending that to be men of peace and international order when they're really just, they're both rapacious and revanchist in their own ways. And this is just, you know, maneuvering to stick it to the West, starting with us.
I agree 100% with that. Clearly, Russia invaded Ukraine. China will not say that. They blame NATO, which is incredible, for this, which, you know, it's not NATO troops that are advancing on Kyiv. It's the Russian troops. So we have to understand, you know, Confucius said, and I think it's the most important thing he said, you have to call things by their proper names. And the proper name for this is a Russian invasion of Ukraine, and China needs to acknowledge that. And if it doesn't, it means that China is a combatant in this war.
I went to a talk a couple weeks back given by Congressman Ike Gallagher from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who's a Marine, and he's heading up, as you know, the Select Committee in the House on the Chinese Communist Party. And speaking about calling things by their name, he made the point to say, yeah, this is why we're calling it the Chinese Communist Party, the House Select Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, because what we're looking at is Chinese Communist Party activities. And he went through the various buckets, right, military, economic, cultural. You know, he wasn't particularly sanguine about where we stand with the Chinese Communist Party as it pertains to any of those aspects of policymaking and power distribution. What is your take? Are we doing the things that we need to vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party militarily, culturally, economically?
No, we're not. And because of that, we're in mortal danger. China, in fact, is preparing for war, war on Taiwan, Japan, Philippines, India, or even the United States. And we have a political establishment in Washington, and it's not just the Oval Office, it's the Pentagon as well, both parties, certainly the elites in New York, who don't understand the urgency of the situation. And that means the Chinese can take us by surprise, and this could lead to the end of the United States. I know a lot of people would think that that's not possible, but China has infiltrated the U.S. There is now credible information to suggest that the Biden family has been bribed. So really, we are at a point where we're not being defended by the president, who has the obligation to do that. And so we are in mortal danger, and Americans, I believe, do not understand it. I know it's hard for them to understand, but we didn't understand Osama bin Laden. We didn't understand the Japanese. And we know what happened in 1941 and on 9/11.
So, Gordon Chang, do you think that, you know, that's a pretty bold statement that we're going to be going to World War III? Do you think that's what they were meeting about yesterday, Xi and Putin?
I think
getting ready for it?
Because we're not ready for it. The issue is whether we go to World War III is not in the hands of China or Russia. It's in the hands of one person whose name is Joseph Biden, Biden can deter them because we have the power to do that. But also, unfortunately, we're not exercising that power. And the Chinese believe, and they might be wrong, but the Chinese believe that they can control outcomes in the Oval Office. So this is extraordinarily dangerous for us at this time. And China will attack if it gets the green light. And the green light is going to be determined in Ukraine. If Russia holds on to Ukrainian territory, China will see a green light to attack a neighbor. If Russia is defeated, I believe China will shrink back.
What are steps to deter China that we could be taking that we're not taking in any of those buckets, perhaps something asymmetrical that they wouldn't anticipate us doing?
There's a whole range of things. But they don't anticipate us doing anything, essentially, because they believe that we don't have the political will to, for instance, cut trade, cut investment, cut technical cooperation agreements, get the Chinese off of our farm and ranch lands. But, you know, in terms of deterrence of China, it really is a question of what they believe President Biden will do. Now, if Biden were to say from the Oval Office in front of a television camera, I will defend Taiwan. And if nobody in his administration contradicts him, like has occurred in the past, then the Chinese might sit up and take notice. But right now, they're not doing that. And they actually tell us we're not deterring them. So we should take the Chinese at their word.
I was talking to a guy from Canada the other day, a businessman from Canada, and he was saying that, you know, the Chinese communists, sort of in the same way that they've infiltrated the academy and corporate America in this country and incentivized them to cast their future with China in China, corporate America in particular, they have done so in Canada. They say the guy's saying Vancouver is essentially controlled by you know, Chinese economic power. I mean, is what's your sense of what's happening north of our border there in Canada?
Well, China is more influential, not just in Vancouver, but also in Ottawa, where it counts. And clearly, Justin Trudeau has known of the malign Chinese interference in the last general election and has done nothing about it. Trudeau says that Chinese activities did not influence the outcome, but I don't think he can know that. And there is credible reporting to suggest that it did affect the outcome. So, yes, we have a neighbor which is closer to Beijing than it is to Washington. Biden's going to Canada, I guess Thursday or something like that.
What are the sorts of things that the Chinese Communist Party is alleged to have done to weigh in on the Canadian election?
They supplied a lot of money, and they most important propaganda in terms of certain candidates of the Liberal Party of Justin Trudeau. But this has been something that has been going on for quite some time. And really what we have got to do is we have to have honest conversations with the Chinese about what's going on in Canada. And Justin Trudeau needs to have those conversations as well.
That seems like another guy incapable of doing anything in furtherance of his country's interests. You wrote a book called The Coming Collapse of China, and it in part addressed what I started out this segment mentioning, the internal contradictions of these totalitarian communist regimes that essentially make it impossible for them to realize the strength of their numbers or the strength of their military in the case of the old Soviets. And so are there things that we could be doing to exacerbate those internal contradictions on behalf of the Chinese people, on behalf of Hong Kongers, that we're not doing?
The one thing we need to do is talk to the Chinese people. Stop talking to Beijing, talk to the Chinese people. Mike Pompeo, when he was Secretary of State, gave a talk at the Nixon Center in July of 2020. And he said that the thing that he did, which irritated and angered the Chinese the most, was when Pompeo directed his comments to the Chinese people. We have allowed Voice of America, Radio Free Asia, and the rest of that to atrophy. We need to realize that the Chinese are conducting propaganda war against us. They're extremely effective. They put a lot of resources into it. And we need to do the same thing because this is Cold War II.
Are there any dissidents to rally around, like we rallied around Solzhenitsyn, again, back harkening back to Soviet Russia? I mean, I know Jimmy Lai in Hong Kong, but in mainland China, are there dissidents that we should be rallying around, that we should be amplifying their activism?
There are. China is run an extremely coercive state, and so many of those dissidents are in jail or in concentration camps. But in effect, there's potentially 1.4 billion dissidents. Mm. We saw this in this extraordinary protest after the November 24th fire in Urumqi, where a protest broke out spontaneously across China. The Chinese people are not happy right now. They are intimidated, of course, but they're not happy, and we can exploit that.
He is Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China and The Great U.S.-China Tech War. And again, follow him on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang, at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon Chang, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dan and Amy.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out.
Mm-hmm. I said, when top of the morning, out. Dan and Amy. That theme music means it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. This was a fun back and forth. Stacey Davis Gates, the latest red in charge of the Chicago Teachers Union, said of CTU, as well as the Purple People Beaters, SEIU, and SEIU Healthcare, they're unions with mostly black and women members who endorse Brandon Johnson for mayor. They're not just, quote, white guys in hard hats, unquote. And, of course, the response from the Chicago Cook County Building Trades dude is exactly why the identitarians are winning.
Oh, no. What did he say?
It did, like, the moral indignation thing, the defensive moral indignation thing. I'm so offended, and our members are diverse. The building trades are a diverse group of highly skilled men and women of every race. You don't know how to play the game with these identitarian apparatchiks. Sorry, Mike Massaleo and the honkies that are in charge of the building trades. You don't know how to play the game with these identitarians.
All right, well, then what should they have said?
Which is why they are on the advance. And it's the same thing. You're going to out-identitarian Stacey Davis Gates? Paul Vallis, you're going to out-identitarian Brandon Johnson? You're not. Wrong play.
Well, what should he do?
Well, let me give you an example of what Paul Vallis should be doing.
All right. I'm ready.
Rather than playing this game of I built the school that you taught at in Cabrini Green.
Yeah.
And talking about systems, you say, you're not going to get to his left with the teachers' unions. So the play is to say, embrace who you are. Embrace what you say your position is. Make an argument. Paul Vallis is running like he's an Illinois Republican, afraid to make arguments. Here's an argument.
Okay. Tell me.
I'm a proponent of school choice. I'm a proponent of making sure that, and this is an argument that he should be making a direct appeal while he's going around with Willie Wilson and others. I want to bring scholarship money to your neighborhoods, to your family, to make sure your kid gets into a school that has a sort of structure and curriculum that is going to propel him or her to success. That's what I want to do. And this is the best way to make sure that your kid stays on the straight and narrow and away from street gangs and violence and crime. And this is the best way to engender a renaissance in your neighborhood by getting more kids out of schools that haven't done the job for generations and get them into schools that provide more of an opportunity for them to get the to acquire the skills they need for success in life. You know, the honkies, even city honkies, they don't understand.
I mean, city honkies.
Yeah, honkies who live in the city. Okay. Even they don't understand the crime issue with respect to the black community. And it's not like I'm a spokesman for the black community, but I have done survey research. So I actually soliciting opinions, how people think about things. And these neighborhoods we talk about, where the, you know, 80% of the crime victims are black and 80% of the perpetrators are black, and it's black and all this. They look at the violent crime and they listen to politicians say the same thing about it that they've said for 50 years. And they sort of are somewhat fatalistic, unfortunately. Unfortunately, this has been somewhat normalized. And so all of the tough talk about law and order doesn't have the same currency that it does in rich honky neighborhoods that are just now dealing with crime that they haven't dealt with in a long time, if ever. It just doesn't have the same resonance. But something like, I am going to provide the funds to get your son or daughter out and to a place where they are going to be successful on their own terms.
I'm going to push back on that because a CTU member hears that, a school teacher, and says, oh, he's going to take away my job. I'm going to lose my job.
Excuse me. Did you hear the first part of what I said?
Yeah.
CTU is not gettable.
I know.
His position is already school choice. I was saying this in the primary when it was clear he was going to be one of the finalists, and that was clear for a long time. Start laying the foundation because you know where you're going to get hit and how you're going to get hit. And he didn't do it then, and he hasn't done it now. It's baked in. They already believe that. They are not going to be with him. They are not gettable. But if you want to increase your percentage of the black vote, in particular, by 5 or 7 points, then make an appeal directly to the future for their family as lived through the prospects for their kids.
Yeah, I can save your son or daughter. Go to the black community if they're near a failing school. And say, help you. I'm the choice.
This is about contrast. This is not about blurring the lines of distinction. But you have to present the contrast, the choice everywhere. And I mean, the clip that we played the other day, Brandon Johnson talking about no homework and no testing. The important part of that clip was earlier when he said, I taught at Westinghouse. Westinghouse was a selective enrollment school. That is in conflict with my philosophy. It's actually a contradiction. It's hypocritical. I'm teaching in a structure that actually weeds out a certain element of my neighborhood. Well, here is the opportunity for contrast, for Vallis to say that it's not weeding out, it's providing opportunity to all the kids, whether you get into a selective enrollment school or you don't. But we're going to empower families to make choice because I trust you and I trust that you have the best interests for your kids at heart, more so than anybody else. And so we're going to provide the resources that the rich honkies have to get you and your family and your kid to a school that provides them the best opportunity for success. That's a contrast. That's an appeal. That's something tangible that people would say, well, I want to rally around that. And by the way, this isn't just idle chatter. This is what's actually happened in states that have expansive school choice programs. That's how Doug Ducey won re-election in Arizona, because of the school choice program and the constituency he built within the Latino community. That's how DeSantis won in 2018 in his first go against Gillum, because of the infrastructure that was built through school choice programs, through opportunity scholarships, and the percentage of black families that benefited. And from starting with Jeb Bush, going through Rick Scott, all the way to DeSantis. And so you get a bigger percentage of the minority vote than you're seeing Republicans in other states get, because you've made an appeal, you've kept your promise, and families have benefited.
It does seem so simple, and you're right.
just one man's idea.
Well, and then Brandon Johnson said something yesterday that, I mean, it's 6 seconds, but it's just frightening.
You're going to elect for the first time in the history of Chicago a public school teacher to the fifth floor.
Yes, sir!
And I'm bringing a whole lot of people with me.
And I'm bringing a whole lot of people with me. He says within the first 100 days, he's going to work on a climate change analysis for the city. He once went on a hunger strike for climate change. That did a lot. And he's hiring young people right away. That's his first priority. That's what he said. To get into office.
For more on all this, Ted Dabrowski joins us. Ted, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. And you know, what's fascinating about what you said is that the move of school choice, you know, just happened in Iowa right next door. Governor Kim Reynolds got that through. So you're talking about school choice happening, you know, in many, many states. And
North of us in Milwaukee, as you know, and it was black city councilman Polly Williams and a honky governor and Tommy Thompson. They got together, and a lot of minority families in Milwaukee have benefited from the school choice programs. And the research that's been done, because you've got 30 years of data now, is pretty conclusive. I mean, there's a strong case to be made. I don't know why your Vallis is not making it when, again, the other argument, the like, I'm a pro teacher and the teachers union rank and file should vote. It's not happening. That is not going to happen.
Yeah, that's not his constituency. And you know, the thing is that for me, too, and I agree with all your points, Dan, it should be so easy to make Brandon Johnson wear a lot of this failure. You know, do you want your kids to go to schools where zero kids can read? Brandon Johnson and the CTU have led that for decades. Do you want your kids to be where, you know, just one out of every 20 can do math at grade level? No, you have to have choices, and, you know, and I'm here to support you for that. So I think the pitch, certainly making Brandon Johnson wear what's happening, you know, put the onus on him. You know, these are his words. I don't want testing. I don't want F's. I don't want standards. You know, he's destroying merit. In his own words, he's destroying merit. And I think that the most telling thing about that discussion you mentioned is that he basically said he was willing to throw the kids at his selective enrollment school at Westinghouse. He's willing to throw them under the bus because they were doing, quote, better than the kids in other. I mean, those words are you know, listen to it. Everybody should listen to them and draw their own judgment. But they're horrendous. And
I would just change one word you used, because it's a word that the left loves, and particularly coming from Chicago, it's perfect time to use it against them. He's not destroying merit. He's destroying hope. He is eliminating hope for your family, for your kids.
Yep.
Listen, and schools are supposed to be all about hope, right? That's where you get your inspiration, your hope. You know, you reach new levels. You get a good score. You want more, right? And instead, this no standards, no grades, no anything. It's why then they can just pass you along the system because there's no measurement anymore. And once that happens, you just go through the school. Like we showed the data, you know, only 10% of kids at CPS can ever read. The black kids can ever read a grade level, and then they're 80% of them are graduated. You know, and everybody lives happily ever after. But this is precisely why Chicago's in deep trouble, because, you know, a big part of the populace is coming out of schools unable to read properly, unable to do math properly. They can't contribute, and that makes it tough.
And every day,
and nobody cares. And I tell you this, nobody cares. That's the problem. In that system, from Brandon Johnson to the CTU to the administrators to the State Board of Education, they've all got this data, and they don't do a damn thing about it. That's the problem.
Well, they're selfish.
That's a big opening for Paul.
I know. Now, every day, all we hear, you know, this person's endorsing this person. Well, today, Mr. Popcorn, Bobby Rush, is endorsing Paul Vallis. But one person that's still sitting on the fence is Governor Pritzker. Here he is when he was asked about it again.
Whatever agreement or disagreement that I might have during a campaign, listening to their views here or there, what I know is that when it's all done, whoever that person is, we need to stand shoulder to shoulder to stand up for the city of Chicago and broadly for the state of Illinois. A successful city of Chicago is good for the entire state of Illinois, and the success of the state is good for the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
As Dan Prof pointed out, Governor Pritzker is Mr. Progressive. I'm the most progressive governor ever. Why isn't he backing Brandon Johnson?
Well, we know him to be very neutral and racist, right? So
yeah,
you know,
right.
Pritzker doesn't get engaged.
He's involved in city council races. Why does he sit on the sidelines in aldermanic races? Because he wants to work with the whoever is on the city council, too. Don't take any chances. Let it just play out, and I'll work with whoever the aldermen are.
He's now in school board races and library board races.
Of course. So it's really interesting, too, because Pritzker's fave on fave, this is a poll that came out the other day, fave on fave in the city is 65-35 favorable. But among Paul Vallis voters, it's the other way. It's upside down, which is really sort of interesting. And even still, he won't go where he is most popular, which is among Brandon Johnson voters.
Well, you know, I think there's a strategy there, and you know, we'll see. We have to wait and see whether it works out, right? Things are pretty close, but there's the strategy. It seems like they're playing is like let Brandon Johnson make his mistakes, let people get to know Brandon Johnson, and Paul Vallis will squeak by because Brandon's going to do what he does. But the scary part about Chicago is there's a lot of people who like what Brandon Johnson says, and that's the hard part.
Right. Let's hope Brandon Johnson wins for my Marxist rank and file, but I don't want to offend the money guys because I may need some of them later.
Yeah,
how's that for the little two-step that he's
Illinois,
doing?
Right?
Yeah. I want to get to this other.
Illinois, you can't.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Make your point, Ted. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a perpetual problem we have in Illinois, and you said it earlier, I think, is that reformers, I mean, you can replace the word Republicans from time to time because they're supposed to be the reformers. We don't know how to make our case. We don't want to stand on principles and make our case. We cave and we appease, and then there's really no difference between the two sides on what goes on. And you know, you see that on things like Amendment 1. We talk about it over and over. You see it on Amendment 1 on the green energy bill and all that, and the reform movement is bastardized.
I want to get to this other report that you guys did at Wire Points. This is really interesting. I mentioned one of the results earlier in the program about Wheaton-Warrenville District 200. Less than half the students can read or do math at grade level. Wheaton-Warrenville 200, you looked at the 20 biggest school districts. Give us some other lowlights of how these erstwhile suburban school districts that are supposed to be so good and parents are so covetous of being in these districts to send their kids to places like Wheaton-Warrenville South. And what are the results?
Yeah, you know, we looked at like the 20 largest districts, and then we picked a select few, and we're going to try to add some more. But you know, first of all, there's a story told all over the state that you can probably almost copy paste everywhere. Far fewer kids than you think can read a grade level, right? So you're talking about we're starting to get comfortable saying that 50% and 60%, you know, reading a grade level is good. Well, it's sad because you know 40% of the kids can't read a grade level. If it's 60%, they can. But not only that, you see the property tax revenues have skyrocketed in the meantime. The spending per student has skyrocketed. Home values are down or flat, and they're certainly way under what's happening in the whole country. And then the teachers are getting these 100% great ratings. And so it's an upside down state pretty much anywhere you go. And you can go to Oswego, right? Just a third of kids can do math at grade level. And yet, you know, property tax revenues are up 30%. Operational spending per student's up almost 50%, and your home value flat. So you know, everybody's taking a whack across the state, and I think everybody needs to know this. Too many people are comfortable about their school district being good. We're in Illinois and all that, and it's sadly a bunch of malarkey when you start looking at the State Board of Education's own data. We're spending we spend the eighth most in the country per student. We have the nation's highest property taxes. And then in most places, just 3 out of 10 kids can read at grade level. So, then you start looking at the minorities, yeah. And it's far worse.
I mean, the numbers, I hope this gets distributed. I certainly will do my part. But go to wirepoints.org and check out this report card on the top 20 school districts in terms of size, because the numbers, particularly in these school districts, as I'm wont to say, that are living off reputations that no longer reflect their performance. I mean, like Wheaton-Warrenville South, that is going to be stunning to most of the parents in that school district. Stunning, and you know, hopefully a wake-up call.
Yeah, and just a final point. And I think you know, we focus on the numbers in this. We all know that there's a whole other agenda, which is the whole, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion agenda, the sex ed agenda, the transgender agenda. And, you know, when I look at these things, and particularly like in the really poor performing schools, there's no focus on the core subjects anymore. You don't hear it. You don't hear, let's obsess about reading. Let's get these 30% reading levels to 60%, 80%. There's none of that. It is all about all the other stuff. And so, you know, a combination of these facts plus the obsession with all the other things that are going on in school districts, it's that combination where we have to put pressure and to hopefully people can combine those two arguments together.
Ted Dabrowski, president of wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Today is World Down Syndrome Day. And
but I'm glad they're including everybody.
Yeah, on the occasion of World Down Syndrome Day, we play some comments that were offered by Frank Stevens a few years back, a gentleman with Down syndrome, who testified before a congressional subcommittee about funding for research into Down syndrome. And this is what Frank Stevens had to say about his life. It's worth living.
And members of the committee, just so there is no confusion, let me say that I am not a research scientist. However, no one knows more about life with Down syndrome than I do. Whatever you learn today, please remember this. I am a man with Down syndrome, and my life is worth living.
And he had a message for those who want America to become Iceland, which is to abort in the womb every child who tests positive for Down syndrome, the prenatal screening, particularly salient in Illinois since we celebrate, at least our political ruling class does, the majority of the state apparently does, celebrate being the abortion leader in the Midwest, how barbaric we are as a state, barbaric. We are as a state.
It's embarrassing. It's sinful.
Is there really no place for us in the world? Is there really no place for us in the NIH budget? On a deeply personal note, I cannot tell you how much it means to me that my extra chromosome might lead to the answer to Alzheimer's. It's likely that this thief will one day steal my memories, my very life, from me. This is very hard for me to say, but it has already begun to steal my mom from me. Please think about all those people you love the way I love my mom. Help us make this difference. If not for me and my mom, then for you and the ones you love. Fund this research. Let's be America, not Iceland or Denmark. Let's pursue answers not final solutions. Let's be America. Let's make our goal to be Alzheimer's free, not Down syndrome free. Thank you. Thank you.
And last year, the end of last year, you had the first man with Down syndrome, Chris Nikic, who completed the Ironman triathlon in Hawaii.
Oh, that's right. That's huge. It's such a tough course. Oh, my God.
And did you catch the Oscars recently? A couple weeks ago? A week ago?
Oh, I sat that one out.
Yeah, well, so did I, for obvious reasons. Celebratory award shows in Hollywood don't hold much appeal for me either. But there was one good moment. It had nothing to do with the detestable Jimmy Kimmel, of course.
Or did it have to do with Lady Gaga helping a photographer who fell down?
Did not have to do with that either. Didn't know about that. It did have to do with James Martin. James Martin is the first actor with Down syndrome to star in an Academy Award-winning film, a short film called An Irish Goodbye, which won Best Live Action Short Film. So he was on stage with his fellow actors wearing his dad's leopard print sport coat to accept the Oscar for Best Short Film. And James Martin, when he was born, story in the Irish Times, his parents were told that he probably would never speak. And there he was on stage in front of pro-abortion Hollywood with his fellow actors accepting an Oscar.
Good for him.
Laura Klassen's organization, Choice 42, on the occasion of World Down Syndrome Day, posted this little tutorial for the left.
I love people who have blue hair. But, like, after they're born, though. No offense. I totally respect and value you as a human being now. But before you were born, it was a completely different story. Just saying, thanks to prenatal genetic testing, we can now off all the people who have blue hair before they ever see the light of day. That's compassion. I literally don't know what that word means. You don't need to say anything. I don't have blue hair, which means I know what's best for people that do have blue hair, which is that they shouldn't be born.
Sorry.
If we stop all the people who have blue hair from being born, the world will be a little more perfect and a little less colorful. And isn't that what we all want? And someone look.
Message received. It's funny when you confront people with choice. Are you pro-choice? Oh, I'm pro-choice. Woman's right to choose, woman's body. Yeah. So you'd be fine if a woman wanted to have an abortion because she tested for the sex of the child and it's a girl, she wanted a boy. I don't want any girls. Right? You'd be fine with that. You'd be happy living in China under their one and now two child policy, right?
It's very generous of them to change it up.
And then when they're confronted with that reality about the capriciousness of it all, oh, well, I don't know about that. What? And the same thing when you, somebody who will have a disability, Down syndrome or some other affliction. Better not that they were born at all, right? That's the compassionate choice. And then you see James Martin on stage at the Oscars. You see Chris Nikic finish in Iron Man. You sure? You know. Right? You know. You're going to create heaven on earth. You're going to decide who gets a chance at life and who doesn't. Because you know. Do you? What do you have to say to Frank Stevens? Everybody applauds. He must have made a lot of people in that room on that day he testified to that before that congressional subcommittee pretty uncomfortable. Because if you truly believe in human dignity, then you can't square that belief with these acts of barbarism. Can you? James Martin, Chris Nickick, Frank Stevens, just to name three. Just three examples. Are you sure you know? Are you sure there's no place for Frank Stevens and James Martin and Chris Nickick and so many other people? No place for them in this world? But you go ahead and you put your pee hat on and you celebrate abortion on demand all 9 months, taxpayer funded, any reason under the sun. And you tell yourself what a feminist you are, what a humanitarian you are, how compassionate you are. Go ahead. Delude yourself. Kevin, Austin, Texas.
Dan, I want to thank you and Amy for doing this, talking about National Down Syndrome Day. As you know, I've called before. I have a daughter who is Down syndrome. And it was, you know, they say that the right is, oh, they're just pro-birth, they're not pro-life. I mm-hmm. find that extremely insulting. And I find it might be the other way around, because to choose to have my daughter born, it was just you really had to look for resources. There was an excellent resource down here, the Down Syndrome Association of Central Texas. And there are wonderful groups out there. Misericordia does wonderful work. And it's a difficult path, but it's the hardest work, but it's the best reward that I've ever had in my life. So just for you to talk about this, I think is wonderful. And I hope you guys are wearing crazy socks, because today is also Crazy Socks Day.
Of course, oh, it is. Always, every day. Yeah, there's nothing more fun stripes. Than fun socks. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, H.W. Bush's, yeah, yes.
But it's crazy socks. My wife and daughter are wearing the crazy socks. It talks about the extra chromosome. And my older daughter would also go into classrooms and talk about what it means to have Down syndrome. They understand more than they can articulate, but they are, you know, they have emotion, random emotions like any other person.
Yeah,
but again, it's just it's wonderful that you guys are talking about. So thank you so much. And it's the whole spectrum of life. So I'm repeating myself. There's so much more I wanted to say, but I just want to mostly say thank you from the bottom of my heart. It's so she, you know, and then she teaches more to other kids that come in contact with her.
Yeah.
So.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Mirror of our on our humanity, isn't it? And for those pro-aborts, how many times have you been on an Oscar stage? How many Academy Award-winning films have you been in? How many triathlons have you completed?
How many Ironmen have you completed?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, though. You know. The all-knowing, flawed human being that wants to gang up on people in the womb who they say don't belong. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've tackled this issue before. Do it again as it's gaining some momentum. Reparations. Again, in the state of California, the Reparations Task Force recommended that each black person in the state who descended from slaves could receive as much as $223,200 in compensation for the past injustice. That works out to north of $500 billion.
And where is that money coming from? Is it growing on trees?
I don't know. Silicon Valley Bank is not going to be able to provide it anymore.
Oh, that hip startup. Anybody who was anybody bank there in Northern California.
I love this line from an op-ed over at City Journal, city-journal.org, publication for the Manhattan Institute. Soledad Usura writing, essentially to read the coverage of this if you didn't know anything about America. You'd think that America is just black and white, just black people and white people, and no other people of any other derivations, because it's just all black versus white in these conversations. But it turns out it's a little bit more complicated than that, because this just in, there are many Americans who are neither black nor white.
There are?
Did you know that?
I did not know.
For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Soledad Usura, finance professional and elected board member of the Venice Neighborhood Council. Soledad, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, good morning.
Why did you want to emphasize that axiomatic point that it's more than just black and white in America, by the way?
Well, when you look at California, for instance, we're a majority-minority state where Latinos make up almost 40% of the population. Asian Americans are 15%. You know, in fact, the black population is at 5%. So what you really see here is just this, you know, what you see is that every policy failure is now going to be blamed on racism. And that's really why our elected officials are running with this. But, you know, it just doesn't make any sense here in California, because what you see is that people who have no affiliation to slavery are going to end up footing the bill.
Well, so, yeah, that's actually a really interesting point. I wonder if that was tackled by the task force. And of course, it's not just California. Some of the big cities have their own. San Francisco, $5 million per. So you can still rack up some real money pretty quickly, it looks like. But right. Why don't Latinos, Asian American, why don't they say, well, we should be exempted? It should just be the honkies that pay.
Well, what you see is this is really a political ploy. When you look at the, you know, our unstable economy, you talked about the, you know, banking collapse. We have an open border crisis. Democrats really don't have much to run on in 2024. So it seems that offering financial reparations for slavery is almost going to work as a 2024 top of ticket issue. So it's really perhaps something that will fully enshrine the black vote with Democrats in 2024, if nothing else.
Thinking about that, California wasn't a slave state, as I recall.
No, it's not. It entered into the Union as a free state. And what's really awful here is, you know, these woke elected officials, they're really projecting all of this racism onto California. It just doesn't exist. And really, you know, Californian history is one of Mexican-American history. And so it's wrong to even make these allegations. So there really is no basis here for any of these claims. You know, Mexico had, I mean, slavery was not legal in Mexico before it was even entered into the Union. So there's really no claims here to be backed up on.
What is the reaction been sort of across the racial spectrum from your perspective to some of these proposals? I mean, when San Francisco came out and said $5 million, I mean, that made national news. That's some real money. And as you do a little bit of the back of the envelope math, too, where's California going to come up with $500 billion?
And that's right. So when you look at San Francisco, that's the one that's in the news right now. The Board of Supervisors in San Francisco, they're going to be voting soon because the final proposal has been put out. And what they've recommended is $5 million to every black adult. They've also recommended the elimination of personal debt. So we don't know how much that will cost the taxpayer. They've also recommended an annual income of $97,000 for 250 years. And they would like for homes in San Francisco to be bought for just $1. So that's going to be very difficult, because in San Francisco, it's hard to find anything under $1 million.
Not anymore.
That's a studio.
Depends who you are. Yeah, it depends who you are. Apparently, there's going to be a lot of homes going for a buck.
And in California, which is, you know, this is the one that I've written about, we still don't know what the final bill will be because they're still deliberating. So the taxpayer is uncertain, but all we know is that this is going to be very big. And, you know, we'll see who ends up with the bill.
So do you think the Democrats aren't doing this for the love in their heart, that they're doing this to lock in black votes to the Democratic Party forever?
And here's really what's happening, you know, because this is really just going to cause... You know, this is going to cause worse race relations among minorities, especially in California. And if our governor, Gavin Newsom, really cared about you know, minority children. He could overhaul our state's failing schools. Because what's so awful here is when you look at California, black and brown children cannot read, write, or do math. The numbers are shocking. 70% of black children and 64% of Hispanic children do not meet state reading standards. And when it comes to math, that's even worse. 84% of black students and 79% of Hispanics cannot meet math state standards. So we all know that quality education is really the foundation to achieving the American dream. You know, it is your ticket to success. And in California, you know, our kids just, they're never going to make it. And so if Newsom really cared about these kids, he could overhaul the state. We could open them up to offer vouchers, opportunity scholarships, charter schools. And the reason he won't do that is because the California Teachers Association is the most powerful force in California politics. You may remember that they came out and they, you know, helped to defeat his recall effort. And so that's really here. So it's really the Democrats, the alliance to the teachers' unions and their political donors.
You're singing our song. We have the same exact problems here.
I just have to repeat that package in San Francisco. $5 million, lump sum, $100,000 a year for 250 years, buy property for $1 and forgive all personal debt.
Where do I sign up for that?
Are there politicians across the racial spectrum saying, I mean, come on. I mean, this doesn't pass the laugh test. This is just lunacy. There's no way that is financeable. Did anybody really anxious to write those checks? And frankly, even some people to receive those checks, do you think that is going to make things better? I mean, maybe for you, if you're on the receiving side, but I mean, come on. Isn't this a come on moment, even in California?
No, unfortunately, you know, we lead the nation in our woke policies. And what is so dangerous here is that this has been allowed to go on for so long. Because, you know, look at the San Francisco, the supervisors. They've really allowed this to go on. And then what happens now when you finally tell people this, you know, isn't going to work out? I think that we're going to see very angry people in California. You know, this is two different reparations task force that, you know, they have been meeting for the past, you know, year or two. So what happens now? How do you pivot? So there's going to be some very angry groups when they find out that the reparations are not going to go forward. And what you see here is, I mean, these are very weak-kneed politicians who put their finger up to the wind and they go along with it. A video that's gone viral recently is one of the supervisors in San Francisco. She was one of the defund the policers in 2020. Mm. Today, she's now crying for police in her own district. So we see that these woke progressive elected officials, they just keep going along with it until, you know, it blows up in their face.
Well, what about the Japanese Americans who are in internment camps in Northern California? Did they get anything? Are they part of this conversation?
You know, exactly. When you look at, I mean, what the task force in California did, the state, they looked at redlining and basically discrimination in housing. But what's interesting here is, I mean, when you take a historical look at this, every immigrant group has faced the same kind of discrimination in housing. So you could make the case that, you know, Chinese Americans have faced even more discrimination with housing. Even Japanese Americans, we place them in intermittent camps. And so when you start thinking about it, you know, why not go back? And maybe, you know, maybe we should give California back to Mexico. But so the fundamental problem with all of this is that the lineage of victimhood, it never ends. Because why not, you know, make reparations to the Native Americans? So this is just it just perpetuates racial antagonism when every minority group has faced discrimination in the United States.
And I'm sure they've shown their work, like how they arrived at 223,000 or how they arrived at 5 million. I'm sure this is, you know, very precise in terms of working the math out to come up with these numbers.
And what they did was they looked at housing discrimination practices, and they came up with an annual figure. They came up with, it was about $5,000 a year, and they looked at a certain timeline. But, you know, redlining was, it did happen in the United States, but these practices, they also applied to all non-white people. Even Jews were affected. So it wasn't just black Americans that were affected. It was all. And, you know, especially what I did was I really took a Latino perspective on this. And what you see here is that, you know, America is not perfect, but for Latinos, this is still the greatest nation on earth. It's the land of opportunity. And that's why everyone wants to be here. And so instead of looking back, we have to look forward. And again, the most important thing that anybody could do for minority children is to overhaul our state's failing education system, because that's really what propels us and helps us make it to the middle class.
But I mean, I'm just still trying to wrap my mind around this. I mean, even San Francisco recalled members of the school board, recalled their Soros-funded prosecutor, Chesa Boudin. I mean, so San Francisco voters are really down for coming up with $5 million per and the rest of that package?
Well, this is a big risk on the Democrats, and perhaps they're really, this is the pilot run, right, in San Francisco. But really, what's happening here is, especially in California, you're seeing that minorities are becoming unwoke. Because you brought up District Attorney Chesa Boudin. It was Asian Americans that organized the recall and the recall of some of the board members. So it was Asian Americans who have really become organized and are fighting back against these woke policies. And then, you know, just across the nation, you're seeing that Latinos are coming out as more conservative, and they're able to flip blue districts red, because for Latinos, it's really about public safety and education. So the Democrats, this is, you know, quite a risk, and perhaps they're willing to go forward with it. Maybe it's a test run in San Francisco and California.
Is this being driven by, you know, white leftists mainly, or is it a cross section of the left?
Well, we only have white leftists in California. This is a one-party state.
Well, yeah, I know, but I mean, but specifically white. Like, is this the brainchild of, well, Gavin Newsom, obviously, but the rest of them, Pelosi and Schiff and Swalwell and, you know, those types.
Yes, I mean, when you look at, you know, who's elected, it is, you know, it's this, you know, really woke crew that we have. They're very detached from reality. When you look at California, what's very interesting is when you look at it, so you see that the coastal elites, all of the cities along the coast, they all vote heavily Democrat. But you go about 45 miles inland, and it's all red. And so what you see is that perhaps California really is a red state, but it's driven largely by coastal elites who are pushing these ideas on us.
What's newly minted LA Mayor Karen Bass, who was a member of Congress for 12 years? What's she doing on this topic? Because, you know, San Francisco's doing their own thing. I assume LA would do their own thing, and other metropolitan areas, Silicon Valley, do their own thing.
So I live in Los Angeles. I've been watching this. I've been wondering why we haven't. I keep worrying that it's going to come here, but perhaps all the worst, or, you know, the most woke ideas come out of San Francisco and they make their way down. But LA has yet to do anything yet, so we'll see.
Well, Godspeed in LA and California, although, again, as Amy said, you could say the same thing about us in Chicago. Soledad Usura is a finance professional, and she's an elected board member of the Venice Neighborhood Council. Soledad, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, we started with Sad Little Man. I guess we're going to end with Sad Little Man. What do you want to flashback to from Tony Fauci?
Well, first of all, that what you brought us earlier today with Fauci and the mayor of D.C. going door to door talking to people, that speaks volumes. Everybody should now. I want to watch the entire program.
Oh, it was good. Here's just a little snippet. This is great.
Amazing.
Where they're meandering in June of 21, meandering through the neighborhoods in Washington, D.C., Fauci and D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and some volunteers or political flacks. What's the difference? And talking to residents, and the residents have the dime on these two. And so, you know, this exchange between Fauci and a female resident of D.C., see who turned out to be more knowledgeable on the topic of COVID and the vaxes.
Well, I heard that it doesn't cure it, and it doesn't stop you from getting it.
No. So on the very, very, very rare chance that you do get it, even if you're vaccinated, it's a very, you don't even feel sick. It's like you don't even know you got infected. It's very, very,
very rare that you get vaccinated and then you get COVID.
And if you
that,
do
that
get COVID,
almost
very,
never happens.
Very, very, very get sick.
Is that what we understand? It almost never happens. You can't get COVID if you get the vax. This was one of the myths that has been roundly debunked by the real world experience.
And I love the gentleman that they confronted and pushing him to get vaccinated and offering him money. Like, can we play that clip? That's
because when you start talking about paying people to get vaccinated, when you start talking about incentivizing things to get people vaccinated, it's something else going on with that.
Something else going on with that. You're right. But I'm glad millions of people like me and most everybody here didn't get an incentive. You know what their incentive was? Protecting their health and protecting the city.
My incentive, y'all campaign is about fear. It's about inciting fear in people. You all attack people with fear. That's what this pandemic is. It's a fear. It's fear, this pandemic. That's all it is.
Yeah, those D.C. residents seem to have the drop on Bowser and Fauci, didn't they?
Oh, my God. And then the last one. I mean, I'm surprised that none of this made the cutting room floor and that they actually aired
this. Left on the cutting room floor. Yeah, this is a forthcoming PBS documentary, essentially. You know, people of importance that you should know. And I think they're intending to profile Fauci and Bowser. But what they're really doing is profiling D.C. residents and exposing Fauci in particular. Listen to this exchange.
What are we going to do about those other states?
Oh, my God. They're going to keep the outbreak smoldering in the country. It's so crazy. I mean, they're not doing it because they say they don't want to do it. They're Republicans. They don't like to be told what to do.
Right.
And we got to break that, you know, unpack.
That right there says it all. And I want to remind people of March, 3 years ago, of when they shut everything down. Listen to the arrogance between Dr. Burke and Fauci. They take this so light. There's such a, you know, air of levity in the room, but they're destroying lives.
I just wanted to read. There's an answer to this.
Oh, yeah.
She wasn't reading the press release, right?
He was my mentor, so I'm going to have to let him speak.
The small print here, it's really small print. In states with evidence of community transmission, bars, restaurants, food courts, gyms, and other indoor and outdoor venues where groups of people congregate should be closed.
What?
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.